By a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff of The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. More than 70 million of us have some form of heart disease. So how can we best treat it? How can we prevent it? Cardiologist Barry Zerit says there's no quick fix, one-size-fits-all solution. Dr. Zerit, who is our guest this afternoon, says any program we embark on must be personalized and sustainable. Dr. Zerit is co-author with Janelle Subak-Sharp of Heart Care for Life, developing the program that works best for you. Dr. Zerit proposes an approach that he says combines the art and science of clinical medicine that will fit the lifestyle and medical needs of the individual adopting it. In the book's preface, he also says the approach is lifelong. And that way of looking at it, he says, quoting here, leads to flexibility, modification, the frequent rethinking of issues, and a meaningful interaction with your physician. Dr. Zerit calls this personalized patient care. Listeners, I invite your questions about heart health and heart care for our guest, cardiologist Barry Zerit. You can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Barry Zerit is Robert W. Berliner Professor of Medicine and Professor of Radiology at Yale University School of Medicine. Heart Care for Life is published by the Yale University Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Dr. Zerit, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Celeste.
What led you to this approach of personalized patient care, individual and lifelong?
I believe this evolved through my own practice of cardiology. I've been at Yale since 1973 and seeing patients on a regular basis while being involved in our academic program. And it became clear that patients frequently do quite well immediately after an event when they're dominated by the fear of survival, the assault that has occurred to their bodies, and consequently they will do whatever is needed for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But that fear factor dissipates rather rapidly over the course of the next year, and you begin to see slippage. And I think as I began thinking about this and dealing with my own patients, it became evident that programs had to be devised to meet an individual's specific personality and specific needs. And while there's a lot of sexiness associated with the one-shoe-fits-all approach or this person's magical diet or magical cure of heart disease, that really isn't the way it works in the real world. We want to develop something that will allow patients to sustain the program for the rest of their lives. And this became clear after, I'd say, 5 or 10 years of taking care of cardiac patients, and it's what I've tried to employ personally in my own practice here in Connecticut.
Yeah. So where do you and a patient begin to build this sustainable program for heart health?
I think you begin by asking and listening as a physician. And I think you need to find out what a patient is all about. And you need as a physician to encourage a patient to begin thinking about what he or she can really do. It's not something that occurs overnight in a relationship, and you don't build relationships of trust with patients instantly. It's something that requires a bit of time and a bit of interaction and a bit of experience. And I think one of the things that's probably lacking a bit in our current form of medical practice, with the rushing and the humdrum aspect of it all, is the ability to listen. I think we as physicians need to listen to what our patients are saying, and patients need to listen to their own inner direction, try to understand themselves better, and then work within those contexts.
Yeah. What's your advice for finding a good doctor?
Ask people who they use. If you know other people in the medical profession, that's always helpful for their advice. And then I believe you, as a patient, need to make an appointment, talk to the person, and understand that person's credentials. Is the person qualified to take care of the condition that you're concerned about? But most importantly, do you develop a chemistry with that
mm-hmm.
with that physician? Is the physician listening to you? I always tell this to patients are often in awe of their physician and are willing to accept aspects of medical care that they wouldn't accept in other aspects of their life. And I say to patients, if you want another opinion, please get it. If you were to buy a car and you didn't like the salesman who was trying to sell you the car, you'd probably go to a different dealership. Why should you be any different about taking care of yourself and your body?
Yeah. Or when it comes time to buy a used car in our family, we take it to a mechanic first. So one of the things that is so sobering about heart disease is this. Of all the people with heart disease, half or more go undiagnosed until it's in an advanced stage.
Right.
So who should be screened?
Well, the question, I think there's really different parts to that particular question. I think there are certain screening tests that are routine and everyone should have above a certain age. And those involve defining a set of what we call risk factors. That is, conditions that you may have that would predispose to developing a heart condition. And some of those are, they're sort of well known out in the world at large. Are you inactive or do you exercise? Are you obese or are you relatively lean? Do you have a predisposition to diabetes or is the sugar level in your blood too high? Do you have high blood pressure? If so, that needs to be lowered. A simple blood test looking at the cholesterol and triglyceride levels in the blood, that is the fat levels in the blood, will tell you if you're at further risk. These kinds of tests should be done in virtually everybody on annual or semi-annual physicals, depending on your age. If these tests determine that you may be of somewhat higher risk than the regular population, then other tests might be beneficial, such as a stress test. And certainly if you have any symptoms that would carefully than we would do with the so-called screening test. Mm. Screening tests are always potentially a problem since there's such a large population out there, many with, but a larger number without disease. They can themselves have certain problems, the more advanced screening tests. But the ones that I described are routine and should be done for everyone. We need to realize that this disease that we call coronary artery disease or heart disease doesn't develop rapidly. It develops over decades. And we have the opportunity now to intervene and to deal with those factors that predispose to it at many points in time. So this is really not a gratuitous thing, but something that can really make a difference. The one factor I didn't mention was smoking, which obviously is also extremely, extremely important. Now, Celeste, the one thing I would say is that despite the widespread occurrence of this condition, we've made tremendous advances over the past several decades. Death rates from heart disease have fallen far greater than any other chronic disease. They've almost halved over a 10 to 15 year period, and that's really rather dramatic. Part of that is because of awareness, and part of it is because people are getting, to use your word, screened, and if factors are noted which would predispose to heart disease, they're being treated.
Let me ask you a quick question, then we'll go take a call. The first time for those tests, those beginning tests, at what age?
Well, I mean, to check your blood pressure or to get a simple blood test, I don't think there's any problem with doing that even in your 20s.
In your 20s.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are people who have elevated cholesterol and the like even at that age. And then you can institute, that doesn't mean that if you find an elevation in someone 25 that you immediately have to jump onto medicine for the rest of this person's life. But it may involve, at that particular point in time, diet and exercise and other lifestyle modifications. And depending upon other risks, you might want to do it even in teenagers. If you encounter folks who have premature heart disease in their 30s or early 40s, then their children might be screened even when they're teenagers because of potential risk.
Yeah, and then they've got a great fighting chance.
Yes, an excellent chance.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. A listener in Terre Haute, Indiana. Line 4, hi.
Hello. Could you talk a little bit about atrial fibrillation and the relationship that has to the pulse pressure and any kind of suggestions for lifestyle, diet, exercise? And,
right.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, atrial fibrillation is a disorder of the heart rhythm. Normally, with each heartbeat, there's an electrical signal that starts in the top of the heart and passes down into the ventricles, which are the squeezing chambers, and leads to an orderly pulse. The electrical signal triggers the heart squeezing and the contraction and the pulse. In atrial fibrillation, that particular order or sequence is totally not functional. And the atrium or atria, which are the top two chambers where the blood is collected when it comes back from the lungs with oxygen or comes back from the body needing oxygen, those two chambers, instead of beating regularly, are beating extremely irregularly. And this leads to an irregular squeezing heartbeat and this rhythm disturbance. Sometimes the heart rhythm can be extremely fast with this rhythm. Sometimes it may not be. Some patients are aware of its occurrence, whereas in other instances, patients don't even realize they're in this abnormal heart rhythm. When this rhythm occurs, it does require treatment, and the treatments are of several types. One involves a medications, and those medications can convert the rhythm and then prevent it from happening again. Other medications may not convert the rhythm but slow its heart rate if it's its rate if it's too fast. And a third type of medication that's required would be an anticoagulant or blood thinner, since when these atria beat irregularly, they can form blood clots, which can go out to the body and cause strokes and other serious problems. A second form of treatment involves what we call a cardioversion, where patients are put to sleep for a very short period of time, seconds, and a shock is delivered to the chest wall, which often converts the rhythm. A third approach involves a catheter placed in the heart and an actual sort of surgical-type procedure to try to eliminate the arrhythmia. Lifestyle changes involve dealing with all of the basics, but they may not help in atrial fibrillation as they would in conditions such as regular coronary artery disease. But nevertheless, you know, adhering to the right diet, exercise, stopping smoking, stopping excess caffeine intake, all can be helpful in this particular situation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Barry Zaret is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a cardiologist. He is the co-author of Heart Care for Life, developing the program that works best for you. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guest this afternoon. Your questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Lifestyle changes. What do you work on first, and how do you build these changes into a patient's life? Do you have to jump right on it, or do you do it a little on the slow side?
Often slow is better than trying to blitz everything at once, Celeste. I think you have to look at the priorities and look at the patient. The first thing that I like to get out of the way is smoking. That may be very difficult, but it's extremely hazardous to the patient. And I think smoking is exceedingly important, and I worry more about that. And frequently, what will come up with patients is, as a physician, I will hear, "Well, I can't lose weight and stop smoking at the same time," and that's difficult. So I would prefer to stop smoking as the first approach. After that's under control, then a controlled exercise program. And with that, phasing in a diet. Diet by itself, without exercise, will work for a while, but may not give you what you want in terms of the sustainability of weight loss and then keeping that weight loss off. So you often have to make choices, and you often have to make priorities, and don't try to do it all at once. It didn't happen all at once. It's not going to go away all at once.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Brazil, Indiana. Line 4, hi.
Hi, doctor. My mother-in-law, who's 80 years old, just had a heart attack, and I would really like you to comment on diet. I have seen her, I've known her for over 10 years, and I have seen her go from the Atkins diet to the Zone diet, and I think now it's South Beach. And I think a contributor to her heart attack is that she probably hasn't been eating well, plus she doesn't exercise. And the other thing is she's probably about 100 pounds overweight. And it's pretty upsetting. She's doing okay, but it's pretty upsetting that there are lots of people who spend lots of money on these high-fat, high-protein diets. And they're not losing weight. My mother-in-law, Norma, has probably gained weight since I've known her. She's a wonderful person. Her daughter is on the same route, eats the same kind of food, doesn't exercise, and is also about 100 pounds overweight. And if you could, because I think hearing from a doctor, people take a lot more, they pay a lot more attention to that than than family members, but just, I think people really need to know about that. I'm going to hang up and listen to your response.
Thank you
very much.
I think one of the things that you should recognize is that there are now a number of studies in the medical literature which show that it's not the specific diet as much as adherence. Each of these diets can work. Some work better in individuals than others. The high protein, the high fat diets, I've always been averse to as a cardiologist, but I've seen them work even in colleagues. And in some individuals, you see not only the weight loss, but also improvement in lipids, which seem in the fat levels and cholesterol, which seems a little unusual. The diets all will work if they're adhered to, and if you look at careful studies, no one seems better than the other, despite the magical claims that each proponent may put forth. Diet alone without some exercise will not work long-term, particularly in someone who is as overweight as your mother-in-law. So there needs to be a component of exercise. It's a pretty simple formula. You take in a certain amount of calories and you burn a certain amount of calories. And depending on that difference, you're going to begin to lose some weight. There are also metabolic adjustments that happen in the body that if you diet alone without exercise, you're not going to get where you want to go. So you have to really look at the diet and the exercise as part of the same basic program, and you need to do both.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you would like to comment on the role of family.
Well, I think the family is incredibly important, and supportive family that nurtures but doesn't push so hard that the patient's going to react the other way can be incredibly important. There are even studies that physicians have done that are in the literature that show the advantage of family in getting better outcomes in patients. So a supportive family, a family that will help with the right kinds of foods, that will not deviate by themselves so that the patient is staring, looking at that wonderful piece of pizza that he or she would love to have but can't, can make a big difference.
Yeah. There's an illustration in the book that I like very much.
Yes.
it's like let's get with the program.
Right, and right. We put that illustration in really to address that issue, which is an extremely common one, and that the issue is the overbearing family member or spouse who treats the patient as if the spouse was a drill sergeant, mm-hmm. and the patient was a poor recruit at Paris Island or something. That backfires. And one needs to get a balance between nurturing and stifling. That's what that little cartoon is trying to point out
yeah.
to people.
So instead of the drill sergeant saying, here's the schedule, let's get with the program, let's check these things off, you say, hey, go for a walk.
Let's go for a walk. Let's not say, you only walked a mile and a half today instead of four. You're not going to make much progress that way.
Well, that caller who called in, I hear in her voice someone who's very supportive and nurturing.
Yes, yes, okay. I think you're right.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one, hi.
Is that me?
That's you.
Yes, thank you so much. I do have this question. I was very active, and then, disease has rendered me inactive. So how do I maintain my weight, because I absolutely believe everything that you said. I have not read, nor have I gotten a book, but boy, I'm really interested. Thank you, and I'll listen off the air.
Thank you. Now, I think there is always some level of exercise that you can do. It may not be what you were able to do 5, 10, or 20 years ago, or even a year ago. But there is an exercise program that can be designed. People who are bound to wheelchairs can do upper body exercises with something comparable to a bicycle that they use with their arms. Swimming is often very good for people who have orthopedic problems. there is, the point is that there can be something that can be adopted or adapted for your specific situation. And that's what we're trying to point out. You need to work with someone, either a physical therapist or your physician, to come up with the program that will allow your disabilities to be respected while at the same time giving you the opportunity to exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if that is also an issue in the mother-in-law of our caller in terms of her age and her weight.
Right, I think it's most definitely an issue. And I have seen this in my own patients, people in their late 80s or early 90s, who have modified what they're able to do so that they can still keep active. Yeah. It can be done. Yeah. And that's the message I would like to leave with you and to other people listening, that it can be done. It requires a little work, but it can be done.
Yeah. Our guest this afternoon, cardiologist Barry Zaret. He is the co-author of Heart Care for Life, Developing the Program That Works Best for You. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Useful in the book are the patient stories that you've included, and one of these is Alice, and I think that this kind of gets at where we've been the last couple of minutes here in talking about what can we do with what we've got. Tell us about Alice.
I will have to.
She's the school aide, and she's got diabetes, and she's a little bit overweight. And she had a hard time getting into an exercise regimen.
She did, and then she made a certain number of adaptations, began taking walks in association with her daily work schedule, and it began to work for her. And she did extremely, extremely well. And I think she illustrates the particular issue of how you can make specific adaptations within what you're doing, your own work style, and your own daily activities to really make this work for you.
Let's take another call. A listener on line two in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I have a quick question, and then I'll hang up and listen to the answer. I have heard about or seen in catalogs recently some sort of exercise machine where you basically just stand on it and it sort of jiggles you around, and they're making claims that for two to four minutes a day or something like that, it's equivalent to a workout. I was just thinking, it occurred to me when I was listening that this would be fantastic for people who do have disabilities if it works, which sounds really weird to me, and maybe you don't know the answer, but it does seem like something we might want to pay attention to.
Well, thank you. I would be surprised if you could get out of that everything that you needed. Standing still and being wiggled is not generally the way to burn calories or to exercise your body enough to make a real difference.
Oh, if it was only so.
If it was only so, we would have a lot. People would be using these machines while they were watching TV for hours each day and would feel like marathon runners.
We'd all be buff.
Yeah, I doubt that this can really work.
Too bad. Let's take another call. Listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. My question is about diet. Are there foods which not only fail to increase cholesterol, but tend to reduce it?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that well. Could you please repeat that question?
Are there foods we can eat which will actually lower cholesterol?
Yes. I think there are some foods that can have a potential beneficial effect on cholesterol and on lipids. And one of the chapters we had in this book attempts really gets into this, in terms of complementary therapies. So we know that certainly by eating lots of fish, this is particularly helpful, particularly the fish that are rich in omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, very common in salmon and other fatty fish. Flaxseed oil can also be somewhat effective, as is garlic in lowering cholesterol. And oat bran has also been advocated as being potentially helpful. And fiber, psyllium fiber, can also be helpful. So there are a number of factors. Red rice yeast is another. And we have a table in this book listing a number of these. So, yes, you can get benefit. The degree of benefit really depends on the magnitude of the problem. How high is the cholesterol? If your cholesterol is at a level of 300 and you want to get it down to 150, it's unlikely that you will do this alone, at least initially, with these additional foods and what some people call nutraceuticals. But they can be effective if you need a lesser drop.
Okay. Does the caller want to follow up?
Thank you. That was the answer.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for the call. What do you think about supplements for omega fatty acids?
I think they're good. I think they can be helpful.
All right. Let's take another call. A listener on line 4 in Fairbury. Hi. Line 4?
Yes. Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I was diagnosed with leukemia about a year ago, and now my doctor has suggested I go on a treatment for it. Can you give me any advice as to the treatment for leukemia?
I'm sorry. Please repeat that. I'm sorry. There was someone who just walked into my office.
About a year ago, I was diagnosed with leukemia.
Yes.
And now my doctor has recommended that I go on a treatment. Can you give me any advice on that? Is this, I'm almost 88 years old. I should say that right off. Will that cure me or put me in remission? Is it put
well, you know, that's a complicated question, and I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer. Leukemia is something that is really cared for by specialists, either hematologists or oncologists.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it depends on the type of leukemia, as well as a number of other factors, including your age and any other conditions. But I don't think I'm the right person to help you in a definitive way. I'm sorry.
I really wondered, since you're a cardiologist, but I thought I'd give it a try.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, bye-bye. Next, we talk with a listener in St. Charles on line 2. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How is everybody today?
Fine. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm doing okay. Could be better. Could be worse. I have a vertigo. I have that, Meniere's disease?
Yes.
And my specialist told me to cut back on a lot of sodium, and I've been doing that. And, you know, it's kind of hard to do that because when you read the back of every label out there, it's got some form of sodium there, you know.
Right.
So I've been doing a lot of research and looking up exactly what kind of foods I should eat, and I've been cutting way back. But my question would be, now I've done this, and it seems like I'm gaining a little bit of weight. I'm not eating a lot of food. I've been trying to eat a lot of vegetables and a lot of fruits, but for some reason it seems like I'm gaining weight, which is I thought was weird, but my wife says you look a little bit fatter than you did the other day.
Well, I mean, maybe it could be that you're doing less physically because of the Meniere, the vertigo, and it's limiting your ability to exercise. And that might be one extra thing.
I'm in the service industry, so I'm getting out and around a lot. You know, I'm not like jogging. I don't go to the. It's hard for me to go to get on any kind of exercise routine, like go to the you know, a health spa or someplace and work out. I try kind of, you know, I'm doing a lot of walking, a lot of riding bikes. I don't know if that makes any difference or not, but because my vertigo and plus my back, I can't lift a lot of weights. So,
well, I'd have to look very carefully at what you're eating all day. You know, sometimes people think that because they're eating heart healthy foods or foods low in salt, they can eat as much as they want. But remember that these foods may have calories too, so that may be part of the problem.
All right, thank you.
You're very welcome. Maybe I know that online there are some calorie calculators and.
There are calorie calculators, and there's also tables that will tell you something about the amount of salt present in food. And, in fact, we have a table in our book that addresses that, the salt content in some common food.
Yeah. And what are your tips for cutting back on salt?
Well, I think you have to first look at labels, and secondly, avoid to start the obvious salt-rich foods. And there are snack foods, salted peanuts, pickles, pretzels, potato chips. Then there are meats that you processed meats, bacon, ham, delicatessen food. And you can avoid salted fish. And something that I find very common in patients is use of canned soups, which are laden with salt. So there are low fat and low salt foods that are available, and my suggestion would be to look up this online, look in certain books, and you can get a lot of information that can be very helpful.
Yeah, and taste the food before you salt it.
Well, I think you should avoid adding salt.
Oh, okay.
Period.
Certainly
if you're dealing with certain conditions where salt can be particularly non-beneficial, such as high blood pressure or situations where the heart is not functioning well and the body is retaining salt and fluid.
Yeah. It used to be a pet peeve of my mother if you salted food before tasting. She said, "You're insulting me."
Well, she's right on both aesthetic and medical grounds.
Okay. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana. Hi. Line one.
Hi. I was just going to address the previous caller. I recall being in kind of a similar situation before, and having some major changes after, you know, finding my numbers all out of whack. And a lot of dietitians do this thing where they have you write down what you're eating before you ever start going on a diet, and then write down what you're eating after you go on the diet. And you figure out the calories both ways. So this man could, you know, go back to, I don't know if he actually has to go back to eating what he ate before, but he could, and write down specifically what he does, calculate the calories, and then do it, you know, with the new diet and figure out maybe he is getting a calorie imbalance and can figure out how to deal with that. Another thing is that if he's doing a lot of, if he's counting like juices as fruits, I did that quite a bit. They have a lot of sugar and they have a lot of calories, and I don't think there's a lot of fiber in juice, so it tends to make you fatter, I think.
I think those points are very well taken.
Okay, that's all.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, I'm a female in my early 20s, and I'm generally very active, exercise a lot. My main protein comes from, like, soy and tuna and shrimp, but don't eat, you know, even meat or anything like that. So I was surprised when I had something of a routine blood test, and the doctor came back and said I had high cholesterol. So given all this, was just, you know, the doctor's response was, well, you know, you didn't fast before doing the test or anything, so don't worry about it. It doesn't mean anything, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was kind of wondering, you know, would some of my testing have affected it, or, you know, eating shrimp and fish and things like that, if it really is something to be concerned about?
Well, you know, there are a couple of points to be made. First, there are individuals who inherit a tendency to have elevated cholesterol, and that tendency may be there despite your most vigorous attempts at controlling it with diet and lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You can change your diet and your lifestyle, but you can't change your heredity.
Right.
It also depends, we have to know more about the numbers. You see, it's not just cholesterol. The cholesterol number is composed of a good cholesterol and a bad cholesterol.
Right.
And the total number can be high, but yet the good cholesterol can be high, and that's very positive. And that may outweigh whatever the bad cholesterol is. So I think it's important for you to know what the numbers are in terms of the good cholesterol, which is called the HDL cholesterol, and the bad cholesterol, which is the LDL cholesterol.
Okay.
And if it's high, it depends on how high it is. There may be other things that you can do. Or if it's very, very high, one might have to consider medication sometime in the future.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Before we are down on time all the way here, before we run out of time, going back to smoking, what do you think is key to becoming a former smoker?
I think a lot of it is between the ears. I think it's a mental thing, and it requires discipline and commitment. I'm a former smoker. And Mark Twain made the famous comment, stopping smoking is very easy. I've done it 100 times. So I know what it takes to stop. And this was a long, long time ago. It's not a recent thing. It's like 40 years ago. I think the most important thing is a commitment to stop and discipline and the ability to seek help if you need it, because there are medications that can help to guide you through the process if you can't do it on your own. My own response to my patients who tell me, well, I'm cutting back, is that that doesn't work. You've got to stop, and you've got to stop cold.
Mm. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, could you tell me if ezetimibe is as good as statins? I'm told that some of the beneficial effects of statins are not there for ezetimibe, even though some people have to take ezetimibe because they cannot tolerate statins, like myself.
Okay. The caller is asking a question about the two. There are two types of drug that can be employed to lower cholesterol. The first is a class of drugs called the statins, and they work on the liver's production of the bad cholesterol, the LDL. Ezetimibe is a newer drug that works on the absorption of cholesterol from the intestinal tract. Ezetimibe, I often think of primarily as an adjunct to be used in conjunction with the statins. And in that circumstance, I find it extremely effective. In patients who cannot tolerate statins, ezetimibe can be used by itself, depending upon how high the bad cholesterol level is. It may or may not do everything that we would like it.
It has done very well for me.
Oh, that's great.
By itself, except I wasn't sure why some of the beneficial effects of statins on prevention of heart problems seem not to be there for this other.
Well, ezetimibe, the statins may have other effects in addition to cholesterol lowering.
Oh, okay.
That's not totally been worked out yet scientifically.
Okay.
But they may work on inflammation. With ezetimibe, it's too early to know yet in terms of some of these other effects. It certainly can be effective in lowering cholesterol.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. We've got to wrap it up here now. One last question. When it comes to, you know, those inevitable lapses and setbacks, how do you keep from getting discouraged?
You keep from getting discouraged by recognizing that you've entered a program that's going to last for the rest of your life. And when you view this lifestyle change as a sustained activity for the rest of your life, a little lapse is a glitch, not a fatal flaw. And I think when viewed that way, if you gain a few pounds, you can lose them again. Too often, a little lapse is a convenient excuse for not doing what you don't want to do. It's got to be viewed not as that, but just a temporary setback, a little side street on the main road.
Okay, be honest with yourself.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Been a wonderful conversation with you this afternoon. Cardiologist Barry Zarit has been our guest in this portion of the program. He is co-author of Heart Care for Life, Developing the Program That Works Best for You, the publisher, Yale University Press. It is 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today with commodity prices in Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Taking a look at the numbers from Chicago today. In the corn pit, things have been edging higher, and today they managed to put a pretty good outside up day in the December contract. In fact, your new crop above the downtrending line. So this should be kind of interesting to see what happens in the session this evening as it starts for tomorrow's trade, too. But for this afternoon, it finished, in the December contract up 9 3/4 cents. They had a high today of 365 3/4. Their settlement at 365 1/4. They were up 9 3/4. We'll get a complete look at those numbers in just a moment, but we'll back up and hit the soft red winter wheat where we always start. In Chicago, the nearby July futures at 611 1/2 were up a half. September futures at 628 on their high, the low at 611 3/4. And a settlement price down a half at 621 1/2. December futures were up 2 3/4 in the wheat pit. 640 the high, the low at 626. Settlement price at 636 3/4. In the March wheat, 645 1/2. The high, the low at 31 1/4. Settlement price at 19 1/2, up 3 for the day. In the May futures, in the soft red winter wheat pit, were up 6 cents at $6.31 a bushel, with a high at that top at the settlement price at $6.31, their low at $6.25. That for the May soft red winter wheat. Now in Chicago, the corn pit, July futures, 8 cents higher. The settlement price and the high were the same at $3.44, the low at $3.32. They finished 8 higher in the nearby July corn. September's $3.52 the high, their low at $37.5, a settlement price at $3.51 1/2, up 8 1/2. And the December contract at 3